from Springfield. This is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We had a good spirited argument in the appellate court today. You heard some of the main points. Again, the issue is, will the legislature be compelled to follow the state constitution and actually abide by our balanced budget requirement?
This case is really about taking away workers' voice and handing it over to a small group of corporate elites, among those being Bruce Rauner.
Illinois congressional Republicans making a plea to President Trump.
They do not want the president to commute the sentence of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Mike Madigan's key staffers who lost his job over sexual harassment allegations fires back.
Kevin Quinn has not responded to repeated questions until today. He's calling his statement, quote, the truth.
State Representative Kelly Cassidy, who herself has accused Madigan of retaliation, called it a despicable attempt to discredit women who come forward.
Well, that former aide to Michael Madigan, Kevin Quinn, begins mounting his defense. We'll talk about that coming up on State Week. Also, a couple of key court cases involving the state and Republican members of Congress from Illinois. They weigh in on a potential commutation for the former governor, Rod Blagojevich. We'll talk about that and more on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, joined in studio by Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, NPR Statehouse reporter Daisy Contreras, and at our Statehouse studio, Brian Mackey, who covers the Statehouse for NPR Illinois. And Doug Finke's our guest this week. He covers the Statehouse for Gatehouse Media. Doug, it's good to have you on once again.
Glad to be here.
Doug, I'll start with you. I want to talk about one of those court cases that was taking place, the AFSCME union. They've been without a contract with the state since 2015. That has not stopped efforts, though, to get payments it says are owed to members. And they were both in the appellate court this week and also got a key ruling from the Illinois Labor Relations Board. Can you clarify what's going on with some of this back pay?
Well, I'll try. First of all, in the appellate court, that is not about back pay. That is about whether the state and AFSCME are at an impasse in their efforts to reach a new contract. The last one expired in June of 2015. They negotiated. They had a lengthy series of negotiating sessions. Didn't reach an agreement. The administration then said that they were at impasse. If they were, that allows the administration to impose its own contract terms without further negotiations. AFSCME said, wait a minute, we think we're still negotiating. There's no impasse. They went to court, and it's now at the appellate court stage, and that's what was argued at the appeals court last week. Separately from that, you have the issue of step increases that are awarded to employees in the early parts of their careers. The idea is to keep them on the job so you don't have turnover, so if they get regular raises, they're more apt to stay around. The administration stopped paying those step increases when the contract expired in 2015. AFSCME went to court, said, no, you've got to continue those because it's a matter of you maintain the status quo when you're negotiating a new contract. AFSCME won in court. The last court ruling said that the issue should go back to the State Labor Relations Board to come up with a payment plan for these employees. The administration asked the Labor Board to conduct additional hearings on that issue, something that AFSCME said was just a stalling tactic on the part of the administration. This last week, the Labor Relations Board said, no, we're not going to have more hearings. We're going to appoint a compliance officer who will come up with this payment plan and get this ball rolling on getting the step increases to workers.
And Doug, I guess just to make it clear here, yes, these are separate issues being argued, but they're kind of connected because the step increases, the way I've understood this, what the Labor Relations Board is saying is that if there is no contract in place, the rules from the former contract remain in place.
Right. They are connected in that sense, but I was just trying to make the point that in the appellate court, they're not arguing about step increases. They're arguing about the overall state contract between AFSCME and the administration. administration.
Well, you cover this quite a bit. Is there anything going on between the Rauner administration and AFSCME regarding trying to get to negotiate a new contract? It seemed as though that stopped a long time ago. You mentioned the term impasse has been imposed, but have there been any meetings, anything taking place on that front at all?
Well, no, and that's why they're in court. So the meeting stopped because the Rauner administration contends we're just not going to come to any, you know, it's clear that AFSCME doesn't want to do what we want to do. We don't want to make the concessions they want. And so that's why they pursue this is the alternate path instead of negotiation. Mm-hmm. And legally, what this really comes down to, I mean, it gets a little bit into the weeds here, but there's something called the single issue test. And the analogy that the lawyer for the administration, the Rauner administration, used is like if you know, it's Springfield, it's hot in the summer, you want to go buy a car, you want a car with air conditioning, and you walk onto the car lot, and the guy says, well, I don't have any cars with air conditioning, but hey, we can talk about the radio, you know, we can talk about other things, and I can make a deal on that. Well, if they're not going to talk about air conditioning, then that is like, no, forget it, I'm not buying a car here. And that's basically what he's saying the administration is arguing about AFSCME. And it's this issue of subcontracting, and do they, you know, can they outsource certain jobs? Do they have to negotiate every time they want to subcontract a function that had been done by state workers? And the administration contends that AFSCME was just not interested in, you know, making any sort of compromise that would be acceptable to the administration on that issue, and therefore they were never going to be able to come to an agreement on the full package because that was like a car with air conditioning in summer, in their view. AFSCME, as Doug said, says, no, there are still other issues, pay and benefits, and we are, you know, willing to negotiate, we're willing to talk, and we want to just keep coming to the bargaining table. Of course, if you take a step back, a lot of people think that AFSCME is maybe just holding out, hoping that their preferred candidate for governor will be elected this fall and they can get a better deal from the next governor, who, if it's not Governor Rauner, seems it would be likely to be J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat who has strong union backing.
Charlie, a lot of times we like to go back and say, you know, well, let's take a look back at how this was handled maybe in the past. But this is pretty uncharted territory when it comes to the state workforce, because going without a contract this long.
And my hesitation is I'm trying to think back. I don't recall that we've ever had this kind of a battle between the AFSCME or any other public employees union and the administrations. But that's because we've never had an administration, we've never had a governor who was so, I guess, anti-union, or at least so convinced that public employee unions have too much power as we have now with Governor Rauner. As a matter of fact, the first contract between the state and AFSCME was negotiated some 30 years ago when Jim Thompson was the governor, a Republican.
And there have been battles with other governors
in the past. Oh, sure, there's always been battles about issues, but it's never come to the point where the administration has said, okay, we're at an impasse, we're deadlocked, you know, it's a waste of time to keep going any further, so heck with it.
And, you know, as Charlie was just saying, you know, this case dates back to January of 2016, you know, when Governor Rauner walked away from the bargaining table, and he wanted to impose his terms. So, you know, like Charlie said, it's very unusual to have a governor so anti-union.
Who can talk a little about the terms that the governor wants to impose with this this idea that if we are at an impasse, here's what you're going to have, and you're going to have to live with it? What is the governor proposing there?
Well, one of the things we know that he has wanted that the union has been adamantly opposed to are some major changes to employee health insurance. And the union asked me, said that the kind of changes the governor wants are going to greatly increase out-of-pocket expenses for workers and lead to lesser coverage. They have just been opposed to that. And in fact, I believe during the appellate court hearing, the attorney for the state said that was another issue that AFSCME said that they wouldn't go along with. And
well, I think, hasn't the governor included in each of his budgets several hundred million dollars, somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 million as savings by imposing these new terms that would basically increase the cost of health care coverage for AFSCME and other state workers?
He has, and the General Assembly, which is dominated by Democrats, has rejected that idea.
Although they did include it in last year's, when they finally were able to do the veto override, I think that savings was supposed to be in the budget. But
part of the imaginary savings.
Right, and we should add, for full disclosure, because everyone on this panel today, except Doug, is an employee of the University of Illinois, it's likely that whatever changes the governor imposed on AFSCME would cascade down to affect all state employees, unless the university decided to separate from CMS. Another thing we know that the governor is trying to do, though, is go with what he calls merit pay, which would, instead of having longevity increases and time in service being the way that you get most of your raises, some percentage of employees could compete for bonuses. From the cost control standpoint, one of the advantages there is that if you're giving bonuses, that doesn't become part of someone's regular income. You don't have to worry about paying for it the next year. You could cancel the bonus program in the future and try to negotiate it away, and that salary, or it doesn't become part of salary, and therefore it's not pensionable. So that's another way that the governor thinks he can control costs. Employees look askance at that and say, how do you award bonuses for some people who are, doing these horrible, difficult jobs in prisons and veterans' homes, and it's not that may work in the corporate world. It doesn't really work in the world of, the kind of tough jobs that people in state government do.
Let me correct something that I just said, too. I made a mistake. It was the idea of merit raises, I believe, that the attorney for the state said that the union was opposed to, that they were willing to negotiate on insurance issues. So I apologize for that.
And one of the drawbacks, or at least that critics of this merit pay notion argue, that it becomes a popularity contest. And if you happen to side with the administration and you're rah-rah for the Rauner ideas, you get merit pay. If you're a union activist, you wouldn't.
One thing I've often thought about when you hear about ideas in government that maybe sound good for the person who's in now, whoever that would be, depending on the listener's political persuasion, imagine how you would feel about it if when the government switches parties, right? So would you like Rod Blagojevich having merit bonuses to hand out at will if you're a Republican today, or vice versa? If you're a Democrat, do you want Governor Rauner handing out merit bonuses to his preferred employees? And that's something where it comes up with judicial selection. You have to think that the administration will flip at some point in the future, and the idea is this a policy you would trust the other side to manage?
Yeah.
Well, before we move on, Brian or Doug,
let me raise another point about this. In a sense, isn't it likely that these issues will not be resolved before we have the next administration begin? I mean, if it's in the appellate court now, whichever side loses in the appellate court will appeal to the Supreme Court, and I would think it'd be very unlikely that the Supreme Court would issue a ruling before November.
Well, a wise former journalism professor of mine told me never to make predictions.
I was speculating.
If things follow the normal course, and the appellate court takes a couple of months to ponder this and come out with an opinion, and then the sides appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, unless they do it on an emergency basis, the earliest they're going to rule on the next round of cases that they'll accept is in late September. So, that would be, and that's assuming the appellate court finishes their decision in time to make that appeal. So, yes, it seems if things follow the normal court process and timelines, it's not likely to be resolved this year.
All right. And Charlie took the question I was actually going to ask. So let me just move along then, because we will stay with the appellate court. And actually, it was the 4th District Appellate Court here in Springfield where these hearings were taking place, another hearing taking place. This one on the recent law that allows public funding of abortions. And Daisy, you reported on that. What's the argument here? We know that some groups certainly don't like it because it is abortion-related. They're anti-abortion. What argument, though, are they making against the law?
Yeah, so now after a trial judge last year dismissed the case, saying a court could not weigh in on a political process or issue, Representative Peter Breen, who's been a longtime anti-abortion lawyer, and some anti-abortion groups appealed the decision. And the oral arguments, like you said, Sean, were heard this week. They're saying that the groups are saying that this isn't about abortion. They say it's a fight about respecting the Illinois Constitution, which they say demands that the General Assembly formally adopt a revenue estimate every year when passing a budget. They say the money wasn't legally set aside to fund what this law would do, which is to pay for abortions for state employees or women in the Medicaid program. But most medical procedures are not separately funded in the budget. So that's an interesting argument that they're making. The defendants in the case argued that drafters of the Constitution left some flexibility and freedom for the General Assembly to interpret this as a suggestion as long as a budget is balanced every year. It's this argument about respecting what the Constitution says, and Breen says if they win the case, this will set the bar for lawmakers and future General Assemblies to respect this.
Charlie, have you you thought this was an interesting argument that's being made as well?
Yeah, I would say in a sense from the pro-life groups, it's sort of like a Hail Mary pass, because if you read the Constitution clearly, it does not mandate that there be some formal revenue estimate adopted. It says in the finance article that the governor has to propose a budget based on estimated resources. The General Assembly has to pass appropriations within estimates of what the resources are going to be. The estimates is the big fudge factor. As a matter of fact, if you look at the budget that was approved, the calculation from the administration and from the legislature is that there will be a surplus. Our appropriations are within our estimate of revenues. As a matter of fact, we'll finish something like $15 million ahead. Now, on a $38 billion general funds budget, $15 million is a rounding error. It's microscopic, but technically it's a balanced budget. Now, people have pointed out, you know, there's a lot of assumptions in there. We're going to sell the Thompson Center again, as we've done the last several years. We're going to have this miraculous new way to reduce our pension liabilities because people are going to buy out of the system and take a new deal. And, you know, so it's balanced on paper in that the revenues are greater than the expenditures. But in reality, as many groups have pointed out, it's not really balanced.
And Daisy, certainly we don't know how the justices will rule on this, but could you get a feel from what they were their response to this this approach in court?
Right before they walked out, they said, "You know, we've heard really good arguments from both sides, and they're looking to read more into it. There really isn't a timeline for when they'll might rule on the case, but I do get that feel that no matter which side wins, the other party is likely to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court, like with the cases that we
just a pit stop on
about.
The way to the Supreme Court, basically,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So, Brian, we started the show hearing from former aide to Michael Madigan, Kevin Quinn. He came out this week. And he was this is the first time we really heard a lot from him regarding these harassment allegations, which led to his dismissal earlier. First of all, go back and if you could tell us who Kevin Quinn was and what's he saying now.
Yeah, this was one of the top political aides to House Speaker Michael Madigan, worked in his political organization in the Chicago area or in Chicago, I should say. And he was abruptly dismissed earlier this year over really two things. One, allegations of domestic abuse. He had been arrested in a what he calls a very bitter divorce and custody fight with his spouse, but also allegations from a former Madigan campaign operative who claims that he harassed her and was made her feel uncomfortable and repeatedly asked her out. She issued text messages at the time. She ended up writing a letter to the speaker, who immediately turned it over to his lawyer for investigation. And then it ultimately led to an equal opportunity complaint and a federal lawsuit, which is still going on now. As we heard at the top of the show, this the accused staffer, Kevin Quinn, had not really said much publicly until he came out with a 14-page manifesto or document this week, which he called, quote, the truth, and said, you know, he basically takes responsibility for making Hampton feel uncomfortable and sending messages and apologizes to her, but he also sort of tries to pick apart some of her arguments and says that, you know, this is somebody who had previously quit jobs. She overstated her importance in the political operation, because one of Hampton's central claims and one of her big legal claims is that her career path was blocked because she spoke out, and this was retaliation. And Quinn is making the counterargument that, well, you know, this is not like she was one step away from being, you know, the political mastermind of the organization or something like that. The speaker's camp has disavowed any association with this argument, although Elena Hampton's, the young woman's lawyer, says that, you know, it sure does look like something that a lawyer would write, and it kind of outlines a case that he expects will be used against her in court.
And there was also some movement this week on the speaker announcing some internal changes as well to deal with complaints like these.
Exactly. Yeah. He basically he and his chief of staff, who is now a woman after former chief of staff Tim Mapes resigned under pressure a couple weeks ago, they're appointing basically a human resources person in the House in the speaker's office. And, you know, people are supposedly encouraged to come forward with complaints, and this person is going to conduct performance reviews on staff and, you know, seek input from everyone. I got to say, from the outside, this seems to kind of go against what has in the past been a very top-down, hierarchical, do your job, don't complain, high-pressure organization. And so it remains to be seen whether this is real change or more for appearances' sake.
And just adding to what Brian just said, Elena Hampton, she said, or she alleged that Kevin Quinn was her supervisor. In the 14-page letter that Kevin Quinn released this week, he says that, no, I was not her supervisor. And so this raises this question about supervisors and harassment and who should be held accountable. Looking forward to see what else comes out of this.
Let me go back to the state budget, because Doug, you wrote a story this week talking about money that's included in the budget for a couple of things, certainly that Springfield residents would be interested in, but also I think for people statewide, that includes money at the state capitol and money for the state fairgrounds here. Give me sort of the quick update on what type of money and what's this money going for.
Well, the money for the state capitol is going to go for a couple of things. One is to upgrade the electrical system because the Secretary of State's office, which is in charge of the capitol, said they don't want a repeat performance of what happened at the fairgrounds a few years ago, where the underground electrical system just failed one day and basically shut the fairgrounds down for months. So they're trying to, as they say, be proactive. They want to replace the high-voltage system that services the Capitol complex. The other thing is they want to do some plumbing work around the Capitol. There were some questions earlier this year about discovering this bacteria that causes Legionnaire's disease. No one ever got sick from it, and it was a very trace discovery, but nonetheless, what they want to do in the Capitol is take care of some of this dead end plumbing piping that exists around here that is a breeding ground for bacteria, and they would eliminate that with the money that they're getting. Also, at the fairgrounds, there was $30 million appropriated for work on the state fairgrounds because, as everyone knows, that place is literally falling apart because of years of neglect and lack of maintenance. At least $7 to $8 million of that would be used for repairing the Coliseum, which is where they used to do horse shows until there were some structural problems that were so severe they thought the building was in danger of collapsing. So they, for safety's sake, they had to shut it down. But there's also that would leave a considerable amount of money that is going to be allocated to other projects that has not exactly been identified yet, but they're talking about doing roof replacements in the worst buildings, repairing some of the roads that are crumbling around the fairgrounds and other work like that.
Well, we know that Republicans in Congress, there have been a lot of speculation that many of them don't want to go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump on some issues. But one that the Illinois delegation of Republicans took to heart this week, sending a letter to the president basically going against any possible commutation of the former governor, Rod Blagojevich. Donald Trump has indicated he might be willing to talk about doing that, ending Blagojevich's prison sentence early. Charlie, this is really a no-lose decision here by the Illinois Republicans, because certainly nobody's going to come out and say, none of their base is going to come out and say, oh, wait a minute, you're being too hard on Rod Blagojevich.
Yeah, I would think no matter how much you love Donald Trump, if you're in Illinois and Donald Trump commutes Rod Blagojevich's sentence, chances are you're going to say, Mr. President, I still love you, but you goofed on this one. And so I'm not going to hold it against my Republican congressperson because he said, don't commute the sentence, and you went ahead and did it.
All right. Well, time now for our notes from the field. Daisy, let's start with you.
Yes. Some might recall State Senator Sam McCann made a third-party bid for governor back in April under the new so-called Conservative Party. So he has until June 25 to get 25,000 signatures in order for his name to get on the ballot. And so he says he has all he needs and maybe even more than that. So we'll see.
All right. Brian?
Yeah, there was interesting news out of Chicago this week that Elon Musk and his Boring Company have been selected to create a hyperloop or a high-speed train tunnel, basically, between downtown and O'Hare. This is a journey that takes quite a long time. Now, they claim they're going to be able to do it in about 12 minutes, which is pretty remarkable, getting anywhere from the outskirts of Chicago to downtown in 12 minutes. But this is really unproven technology. It's supposed to be at no cost to the city. But, I guess the question is, will this be, an exciting new entry into the space age for the city of Chicago, or will it be kind of like Springfield and the monorail on The Simpsons?
And Boring only in name only, right?
Yeah, so it's a clever disguise.
All right. Charlie?
Well, we talked about some issues that are going to be before the Supreme Court, probably. When that happens, there will be a new justice. We're getting a new justice, P. Scott Neville Jr., who will join the court Friday, and he will become the second black justice in state history. The first is the gentleman he's replacing, Justice Charles Freedman, who is leaving the court after being on it for, goodness, years and years and years.
27, I think. Was that right, what Brian, I think, reported?
That would be right, yes. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Because he joined after the election back at 90.
Okay, and Doug.
Well, from the world of sports, we have a softball game between the Missouri legislature and the Illinois General Assembly. It occurred in Busch Stadium this last week, and Missouri won 7-4. Apparently, after the game, there was some question that the reason Missouri won is because they have term limits and they could field a younger team. So we'll see where that goes.
All right, that'll do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and Gatehouse Media's Doug Finke. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.